From our microphones in downtown Washington, D.C., this is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. You know, we're going to have an interesting conversation today, ladies and gentlemen, about crime in the media. But it won't be crime in the media 2010. It'll be crime in the media 1704. And we have what I consider to be one of the most interesting gentlemen I've ever talked to, Dr. Anthony Vaver, Tony Vaver. He is the author publisher of EarlyAmericanCrime.com. That's www.earlyamericancrime, that's one word, .com. But before introducing Tony, our usual commercial, we're up to 200,000 requests for DC Public Safety radio, television, blog, and transcripts. We are always appreciative of your comments and your suggestions, either good or bad, in terms of new programs or in terms of what it is that you like and dislike about the show. If you need to get in touch with me directly, it is by email, Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D, .Sipes, S-I-P-E-S, not T, but P, at csosa.gov, or you can follow me via Twitter. That's twitter.com/LenSipes, L-E-N-S-I-P-E-S. And back to our guest, Dr. Anthony Vaver, author and publisher of EarlyAmericanCrime.com. Tony, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
All right. We started off the show with the concept of the impact of the media, crime in the media. Everybody's interested in crime in the media, but we're talking about 1704, or when newspapers were just established in the United States. We're talking about the history of crime. We're talking about the history of media coverage. And I just find this extraordinarily interesting because you cannot understand America. You cannot understand the criminal justice system. You cannot understand crime unless you know where we came from, unless you know what was happening a couple centuries ago. That understanding grounds us, correct?
That's correct, and that's one of the reasons why I started the site, is because crime is so much a part of our history, of our culture, of our society, and it just seemed to me that we don't really know a lot about the early history of our crime, going back to our colonial days and even into the early United States, and that seemed like an odd notion to me, given the place of crime in our current day society.
And again, it was the idea of understanding it. Somebody once said about the Civil War that before the Civil War, we referred to this country as the United States R, and after the Civil War, we referred to this country as the United States is. So before the Civil War, we were basically sort of a country, almost a confederacy. The 50 states had an immense amount of power, but after the Civil War, it settled the question that we are indeed one country. And 50 states, well, not 50 states, I forget how many states there were back then, but the point is that we were a solid country and we referred to ourselves as a solid entity rather than an entity of states. And that's a profound difference in terms of how Americans looked at their country, and it makes a profound difference, I suppose, in terms of how we look at ourselves today. The American Civil War defined us, but everything that we're going to talk about today defined the criminal justice system of today.
That's right. And when we talk about the criminal justice system, especially in early colonial America, there's no way to really talk about it as one entity. And that's for a variety of reasons. And one of them is that the colonies all had their different ways of going about, their different laws, their different ways of punishing crime. So you can't really talk about crime in one way, in the way that maybe we can today to a great degree. That there are different laws. You have people who are coming over and where there's essentially no criminal justice system, and so they're making the laws up as they go along.
They're making it up as they go along, and that's an interesting concept.
That's right, and it's not even necessarily the people who served as judges or had great insight into the law. Usually it's the person in the community who had the most experience, and that could have been just as a either as a lawyer, but it could even be down where maybe even they had more experience in court, maybe as transcribing the court proceedings, or the barristers, or whatever. It's whoever had the most experience was the one who is usually the one who's ending up making up all the laws.
Just to ground our listeners, that before the American Revolution, we were in essence an English entity made up of colonies, 13 colonies all under the British crown, correct? So English common law came with English rule.
That's right. And they thought of themselves as English people. And when we, you know, talk about the newspapers as reporting on crime, they're also reporting a lot about the goings-on over in England. And very often you have reports about criminals over, criminal happenings over in England also being reported here in America. So you have the famous Jack Sheppard in 1724 who's escaping from Newgate Prison, and all of his exploits are being reported in the American papers because there's great interest of what's going on.
Well, that's very interesting. So even at that point, even in the earliest days of our history, there were folk criminals. So there were criminals who people were extraordinarily interested in crime and criminals.
Absolutely. And when you have the first newspapers where you had your first regular newspaper in 1704, and they included stories of crime.
Okay.
And most especially pirates. Pirates were a big theme because of their effect on shipping and trade. And a lot of the newspapers were there to facilitate information that was important to people who were involved in trade and the merchants. And so to know that there were pirates out there who were getting in the way of their ships going across the Atlantic, that's
Understood.
Important information for them to know.
Understood. Now, the media coverage of that time, I remember reading newspapers from that era, not physical newspapers, but reproductions, or not even reproductions, simply accounts. They make today's newspaper reporters look like scholarly madams. I mean, people complain about newspaper coverage, about media coverage and crime today. Back then, it was just 1,000 times more scandalous. Is that a way of accurately putting it?
Or you could say sensational.
Sensational, better word.
Right. There isn't the, the protocols in place that we think about in terms of newspapers. And although the very early accounts, when you talk about, you know, the very early 18th century, a lot of the newspapers, because it took so long for the information to be disseminated, that a lot of the stories of crime are very short. They're just simple reporting on that so-and-so was executed last Wednesday, and left it at that, because at that point, most of the people in the community, by word of mouth, already knew about it.
Okay.
So this is just reiterating what's going on.
That's just being the paper of record.
That's right. But as newspapers go along, they become you have a greater readership. They become more sophisticated, more interested in what's the goings on of what's happening in America itself. And so you get greater accounts of what's going on. What's actually interesting, I just read a book on called American Homicide,
mm-hmm.
and talked about where it's a pretty amazing project where they compiled murder statistics historically and went through all the newspapers, all the court trials, everywhere that they could get some sense of what the nature of murder is all about.
Right.
And at the very end, he actually said that the statistics for the 20th century are actually much less complete, because the people, in terms of reporting on the crimes or counting on them, or of murder, that the issue of motive was reported right away.
Hmm.
Whereas now, people are, because you have to wait for the cases to go through the court,
right,
that the kind of reporting isn't as detailed. So when you talk about newspaper accounts being willing to speculate all over the place as to why this person committed the murder and
right.
the circumstances behind it, they're much more detailed, actually, you know, in these early accounts.
Or speculative.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. Now, crime is a political issue throughout this entire era. And again, under English rule up until the Revolution, and then the American colonies form a country and pretty much go off on their own. And crime and politics and media coverage were as intermingled then as they are intermingled now, correct?
Absolutely, and so crime can often be used to make points. And one of my interests is in the institution of convict transportation, where convicts from Great Britain were transported to colonial America, and that began in 1718, and only came to an end in 1775 when the American Revolution came along and put a stop to that. And that's actually when Great Britain had to scramble and eventually came up with the idea of sending their convicts halfway around the world to Australia. Colonial America was the first destination for convicts in terms of being transported.
The American colonies, and again, it's a matter of balance. Georgia, which I was just through the other day, was a penal colony, correct?
It wasn't, actually.
Okay, tell me.
It was set up as a place to send debtors, and so the experiment, it first started off where James Oglethorpe sent a couple shiploads of debtors to the colonies, and thinking that they could be better put to use there. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they were disappointed with the results. That they were just as some of the politicians said, they were just as unwilling to work in the colonies as they were in England. And so, in actuality, Georgia never really did serve as a place for convicts. And in fact, none of the colonies ever did function as a penal colony. Most of them were sent to Maryland and Virginia, and they were auctioned off as indentured servants.
Right.
They would serve for 7 years.
But is there a way of getting a sense as to what percentage of the American population at that point were made up of people, whether they were debtors or whether they were burglars or whether, regardless of their crimes, an awful lot of these individuals came over and settled in the American colonies.
That's correct. Mostly because as you can imagine, once they finish out their term, it's very expensive to return back to England. And we actually don't know a lot about what happened to them. Some of them went down to the Carolinas. Some of them went off to the cities. Mm-hmm. But there are people who sometimes changed their names so that they could rid themselves of their criminal past.
Right.
And so it's very difficult to actually trace what indeed happened to these people. But there were over 50,000 that were
50,000. That's amazing.
Through the 18th century, and that basically they accounted for that particular time a quarter of all of the immigrants coming from.
That's amazing. 25% of everybody residing in the colonies at that point.
Not residing. The immigrants coming over.
Right. 25%
exactly.
of the immigrants coming over.
Coming over during the 18th century. Were,
amazing. But a very large percentage, nevertheless. And what was the impact? We talked about English cities during this time, and we have this Dickensian sense of overcrowded cities, of kids just running pell-mell, of shoplifting and burglaries and drug addiction and drunkenness and overcrowding and poverty. And so that was the English experience. I don't know how stereotypical all that is, but they used to execute people on a regular basis for minor crimes. So they could pick you up shoplifting and execute you in England. Correct or incorrect?
That is correct, and that is where they ended up coming up with the convict transportation system. It was before that time, if you were a petty thief and were picked up, you were you could claim for your first offense, you could claim what was called benefit of clergy. And this was something that grew out of the from the Middle Ages, where if you could prove that you could read, then you were obviously a part of the clergy, and therefore fell under ecclesiastic laws as opposed to the secular laws.
So they would memorize a passage of the Bible and read it.
Exactly. So that's what ended up happening. It ended up being a farce because you have all these criminals then that knew what to. They'd memorize the passage, and they'd come in, they'd say it, and they were let off. So finally, the Parliament just institutionalized that and said, okay, anybody who comes in, does their first offense, you're branded with a T on your thumb to show that you've actually been caught once, but and then let go. And then your second offense, if you're brought back in, that's when you're subject to execution. But either way, there were a lot of crimes that sort of fell in the middle, where it didn't seem like letting the criminal go with a brand, and sometimes the branding, if you could put a few coins in the brander's hand, you could make it a little colder than what it needed to be to actually make it, you know, brand the actual thumb.
Right.
Or you're hanging someone for, you know, for an offense, and there really wasn't any middle ground. And that's when they came up with the idea of convict transportation and sending people over to the colonies so that they can actually work over here in the colonies that needed the labor, could put these people to work.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're more than halfway through the show. Our guest today is Dr. Anthony Vaver, Tony Vaver. He's an author, publisher of EarlyAmericanCrime.com, www.earlyamericancrime.com. He has a PhD. Tony, was my stereotype of English cities during that time period correct?
The English cities, absolutely. In terms of the cities in colonial America, they were quite different. I mean, they were.
Now, isn't that fascinating? With all those criminals that England shipped over to the United States, or I keep saying the United States, to the colonies, with all those criminals that they shipped over here, and we're talking about what again, 50,000?
Right, but again, most of those went to the plantations. To work on plantations.
Right.
And so, but as the cities grew, then crime did become more of a problem. And so when you get into the later parts of the 18th century, you do have a rise in property crime, in theft, in burglary.
Okay.
And so that's what, so the American, cities then begin to take on more of the character of the English cities.
Okay, and the newspaper coverage at the time, in terms of this rising crime in Baltimore and Philadelphia and New York and Boston and Savannah, Charleston and New Orleans, I think, were the big cities at the times. They said what about this rising crime? Did it become a political issue?
Absolutely, and certainly one of the it called for greater and greater punishments. And so for burglary, which really wasn't much of a problem when you have towns where most people knew each other,
right,
and could handle it. Well, once you start having bigger cities where you have sort of criminals who are journeymen, who are traveling around all over, say, New England and committing burglaries in different places, it becomes more and more of a problem. And so there was greater and greater calls to create greater penalties for this. So,
but it wasn't prisons at the time, right? It was like branding individuals or flogging them publicly or putting them in stocks or fining them, right?
That's right. That's right. And a lot of the colonies had a sort of, for burglars, like a three strikes and you're out kind of proposition.
Really?
Where the first time that they were caught, they were subject to branding and to whipping. And then their second offense would be something harsher than that. Maybe they were banished from the colony. And then for, if they were caught once again, then they were subject to execution.
Interesting.
So, so burglars were actually executed up until, say, the very late 18th century. So even after the United States was formed. But it, but to go back to your also another example of how crime was used politically, as you can well imagine, here was England sending over all of these convicts to colonial America. And a lot of the people here didn't take a liking to that. You know, that here,
right,
that they were treating America as a dumping ground for the people that they didn't want to have, didn't want to take care of over in England.
Which was true.
Exactly, that's right. But of course, ironically, what with the as soon as these convicts landed, they were bought up almost as soon as they landed because they were such a bargain in terms of labor, and the need for labor on the plantations was so great. And so even though we didn't like the idea of them being sent over, the actions of the plantation owners were quite different because they actually wanted them. Well, Ben Franklin, who ran the Pennsylvania Gazette, he was one of the people who didn't take too kindly to Great Britain sending over their convicts. And so he used his newspaper, where he first reported on several crimes that were going on in Maryland. So, for example, a gang of thieves who broke into a Maryland home and then robbed a store of goods. He gave another example of a forger who came from a well-respected Maryland family, but supposedly turned to crime under the influence of the transported convicts that mm-hmm. were employed on the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes through and talks about some of these crimes that are going on in Maryland, and then he comes up with a proposal saying that, well, if England thinks that it's a good idea to send over as trade their convicts, that we certainly should send something back. And he proposed sending rattlesnakes back to England. But he also went on to point out that actually England was going to would have the better of the deal because rattlesnakes actually give warning before they, to quote him, he says, "For the rattlesnake gives warning before he attempts his mischief, which the convict does not."
So we have newspapers and politics, sensational, very, very, very sensational, attacking newspaper articles, and politics and crime were all intertwined almost as they are today. I mean, again, it makes the newspapers and the media coverage of today seem tame compared to the newspaper coverage back then, or the media coverage back then. But it was all intertwined just as it is today, and we had a three-strike system back then just as we do today.
Yes, absolutely.
Amazing. And that was under the English system. One quick question. The individuals who were transported as convicts, were they indentured servants? Were they given their freedom after a certain amount of time?
Right. They would serve for 7 years. And at the end of that 7 years, then they were given their freedom.
Okay.
And for a little while, they were allowed to, once they served out their term, they were then subject to certain provisions from the planter to help out with the convict to get settled here in America. But then eventually the Virginia legislature thought that was too generous and really took away all of that those provisions. So they were essentially out on their own once they finished.
And the whole system ended when the English instituted slavery.
Well, they worked right alongside slaves throughout this period, and it really was the American Revolution that brought an end to the convict, the indentured servant, in terms of the convicts coming over.
Okay, but it was slavery that it was pretty much the death knell of the indentured servant or convict labor, or and through the American Revolution.
Right. Eventually, slavery does take over as the chief form of labor on the plantation.
On the plantation system, but basically, it was. When did slavery begin?
Slavery goes back to the very beginnings. It's like the late 17th century, but really doesn't. It's during the 18th century, during this time, that really it comes into its own.
Okay.
And you do have sort of the development of the slave system and seeing the benefits of it. Because one of the problems when you have an indentured servant, yes, it's cheaper, but on the other hand, once they're done, then you've lost
their labor.
Their labor, right?
And again, I'm certainly no expert on slavery. I was told that slavery began along the lines of the convict labor / indentured servant, where the whole idea was to be free, but that the planter system wouldn't support that eventually, and the whole thing became total slavery as we understand it today, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know much about that myself. Not surprisingly, a lot of the merchants who transported convicts over were also or had been slave merchants as well. So they had the experience in moving large numbers of people across the ocean, and so they also ended up being the ones to transport convicts.
Tony, we only have a couple minutes left in the program. Give me a sense of the typical American, and I say American because both under English rule in the United States, it's still American. The average American city in 1750 in terms of crime, is it, where we say to ourselves today, certainly I'll go to New York and certainly I'll go to Manhattan, but I'm not going to go to this part of the city or I'm not going to go to that part of the city because, they're dangerous. Do we have that same sense of dangerousness in 1750 as we do in the United States of today?
I don't know if it's to the same degree or in the way that we particularly think about it, but certainly when you do have large reports of crime and a sense of, let's take for example, again, I'm very interested in burglary lately, and you have a slew of burglaries that are taking place among the shops, say in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and certainly that gives the shop owners they become scared that they're going to be subject to it, and so that returns back to our political point of how that only generates more and more support for firmer penalties.
Right. Now, there was a period of American history before we go. Try to cram all this into a half an hour show is pretty tough to do. But there was a period in our American history. I mean, Baltimore was known as Mob Town. it was that's my home city, and it was political, and it was, you would actually have like the Gangs of New York by Martin Scorsese, you would have gangs go after each other, and it was pretty scary. I mean, there was a certain point where I'm trying to put this into context. It strikes me that the early American city of 1750 was principally property crime, correct?
That's correct.
And not necessarily violent crime, stranger to stranger violent crime.
That's right. It's, usually when people talk about crime, and this was, even the case over in England, is when you said crime, you basically meant property crime. That's
okay.
What comes to mind. Whereas today, when we talk about crime, I think it's there's usually much more of a violent aspect to it.
And that's
terms of our imagination.
And that's what people seem to fear the most. But then again, at a certain point where, the United States does become the United States under the Articles of the Confederation and eventually onto the Constitution, and we, if you will, control our own cities, is no longer under English rule. But these cities are pretty mobbish places politically, but not necessarily. Did people see this disruption, the growing political parties and the opposition of the political parties, and then we had immigrants coming in? My Irish my Irish family tells me about all these stories about the Irish when they first came to the United States, and how there was a lot of political turmoil ethnic turmoil, but was that considered crime in the same way that we consider it crime today?
Well, certainly the as you do have an immigrant population moving into the cities, that really is something that does contribute to the rise in crime. Also, in terms of the way that you relate to your community, there's when you have, say, Pennsylvania, where you have a Quaker society that's trying to put in a just society where everybody shares the same values. But once it becomes clear that that you have these immigrants who are coming in who have very different ideas of how society should be and how society functions, that then you have a conflict. You have a conflict between those groups, and so the idea that we're all in it together suddenly breaks down. And once you have that breakdown of community, then you have greater and greater opportunities for crime to be carried out.
And the signs go up saying no dogs and Irish allowed in the store.
which
certainly does send a certain message. Our guest today, and Tony, I got to have you back. We're out of time, and I really do need to have you back because I find this all immensely interesting. It doesn't sound like there's a whole heck of a lot of difference between the American experience of 1750 or the American experience of 1800 and what we have today. Our guest today, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Tony Vaver. He is the author, publisher of earlyamericancrime.com, really fascinating website. I like to go to it, and it grounds me in my understanding of the criminal justice system, and it will do the same for you. EarlyAmericanCrime.com, the address, www.earlyamericancrime.com. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We are up to 200,000 requests for the radio, television show, blog, and transcripts. Again, we really, really, really appreciate all of your comments. Some of them, don't deal with the show. Some of them deal with personal situations. We'll try to help you out the best way that we can. If you need to get in touch with me, it's Leonard, LEONARD.Sipes, SIPES, at CSOSA.gov, Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency in Washington, D.C. You can follow me or the program by via Twitter at twitter.com/Len, LENSIPES, and please have yourself a very, very pleasant day.